The Bookmark on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome back to the program John Scalzi. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, John. I see you made your deadline and you got your new book out. It's called Head On. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It was touch and go there with the deadline for a bit, but it finally got done.
And it's described as a novel of the near future, and I think this is true. This is a good estimation because the way things are going, I can see this being very real.
Well, and that's, you know, what I was hoping for. What you want to do, particularly when you're writing fiction that takes place, you know, 10 or 20 or 25 years in the future, is you want to take the elements that exist today in terms of technology and society, and you want to make it a reasonable extrapolation from where we are today. I mean, if I'm writing a book like The Collapsing Empire, which was the book previous to this, that takes place 1,500 years in the future, I can think up anything I want because there's nobody who's going to be able to check my math on that, right? Mm-hmm. We're not going to be around in 1,500 years. But people are going to be around 10, 20, 25 years from now, and they can sort of sense what is possible within a 25-year time frame. And so for that, you really do have to be careful. It's much more difficult to write something that feels like realistic near fiction, near future fiction, than it is to write something that takes place 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 years in the future.
John, I know you're always looking to cross new borders and do new things, and I was pleasantly surprised when I read this book that first of all, it's a murder mystery, and it's a crime novel, and it's also sci-fi, and it has all these different elements, and I love that about it.
Mm, thank you. Well, one of the things that I always tell people about science fiction, and I think that people are sometimes amazed to discover, is that science fiction, you can be incredibly broad with what you do in science fiction. It needs to have the speculative elements about what goes on in the future or speculative elements about technology or whatever. But within that framework, you can write murder mysteries like I did here. You can write love stories. You can write comedies like I did with Red Shirts. You can pretty much do whatever you want. And for me, that's kind of a great thing because although I love science fiction and it's been very good to me, you know, one of the things is I didn't necessarily plan on writing science fiction when I first started writing fiction. Literally, when I sat down to write my first novel, I flipped a coin, and if it was going to end up on heads, it was going to be on science fiction. If it was going to land on tails, I was going to try to write a murder mystery.
Oh.
So because those were two genres that I had read a lot in and had a grounding in. So for me, to discover that science fiction was in fact about doing whatever you want to do within the framework of speculation about where we're going to be in 50 or 100 or 200 years. That was actually very freeing, and it allows me to do quite a lot. I'm very happy about that.
The book opens with a headless threep. What's a threep?
A threep is an android body that is controlled by people with Hayden syndrome. And Hayden syndrome is a disease in the future. It basically sweeps the earth like a plague, sort of like the great influenza virus of 1917-18. And it killed hundreds of millions, but some of the people who survived find that they are completely locked into their bodies. Their brains are working just fine, but their bodies don't move, and the voluntary systems are kind of offline. And so there's a technological impetus to help get out of their brains, so to speak, and that includes complex neural networks and also these things called threeps, which are bodies that allow them to move around in the world. So it's sort of like virtual reality, you know, meets droids.
John Scalzi joins me on the program today. His new novel is Head On. Very funny title, John. And your protagonist in this one is a character named Chris Shane. And Chris Shane is an FBI agent. Tell us about Chris.
Well, Chris is a Hayden, which means they are one of the folks running around in a three body. And one of the things that's interesting about Chris is a scion of a very sort of wealthy family. And the father is a former NBA superstar who is now in real estate. Mom is basically the brains behind the operation. And Chris was a poster child for Hayden syndrome and grew up famous, got sort of disenchanted with that, and then decided to go into the FBI and try to have a real job and a real life. And what's interesting about that is the past always, of course, comes back. People are like, hey, you have the same name as that person who is super famous. And he's, you know, and Chris is very much, well, what are the odds on that? So that's one of the things about Chris, which is kind of interesting. The other thing that's, I think, been interesting for people, and we didn't talk about it in the first book, but we're more free about talking about it now, is that I made the decision when I started writing the first book that in the series, which was called Lock-In, that I wouldn't know Chris's gender. Chris moves around the world in a threep body, and threep bodies are not necessarily gendered. So a person meeting Chris in a threep wouldn't know whether Chris was male or whether Chris was female, whether Chris was gender fluid or whatever. And so for the purposes of the book, it's never been an issue. And that is sort of fun to explore. Like I said, in the first book in the series, Lock-In, I didn't tell anybody about it, not even my editor. I sent the book in to the editor, my editor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden. He read it. And then when he was done, I was like, well, what did you think about it? And he said, oh, I like it. I like the character. I think he's a really good, you know, a really fun character. I'm like, why do you think Chris is a he? And he was like, paused for about 10 seconds. He's like, I can't believe you got me. But it was really interesting to see in the first book how people defaulted Chris, whether they thought Chris was male, whether they thought Chris was female or something else entirely. This second time around, you can't kind of trick people twice or not bring it up twice. It's something that we've talked about a little bit more. But even now, even people who have read the first book, even after 4 years, are still sometimes surprised to find out Chris's gender is never revealed.
You tricked your editor. That's impressive.
I didn't try to trick my editor. I merely did not inform my editor that this is the thing that was going to happen. And like I said, it's been very interesting when people don't know how they choose to gender Chris. And it turns out, you know, nearly all men gender Chris as male. And among women, about half gender Chris as a man and half gender Chris as a woman. And that speaks kind of in a kind of an interesting way to the sort of what our defaults are in society. Now, the one thing that's really important is that I didn't do this particularly in the first book, but even in this one, I'm not doing it to make a huge statement about gender or gender relations. I mean, as a straight white dude, I'm not the flag carrier for that particular conversation, but I do think it is interesting, and part of the point of doing it was in a very subtle way to make people think about why they think about the things that they think, even when they're not aware they're thinking them.
John, another thing about this that surprised me was In a way, this is a sports book. Of course, it's kind of a demented sport that you've invented, but it's a sports book. And since it is a murder mystery, I guess we need to talk about the initial murder in this one and the relationship to sports, because this is really a lot of fun. I could tell you enjoyed writing this sport.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The thing is that when I started writing the first book in the series, Lock-In, I built the world of what the world would be like because of folks with the Hayden syndrome and how their lives would go and how they would be integrated in society. And one of the things that I thought about is, since folks who are Haydens wander around in these Android 3 bodies, sooner or later someone was going to figure out, hey, these bodies, you can pretty much do anything with them. And the person who's driving them isn't gonna die, and so that was the whole point of Hilketo, which is the sport. The idea that you could finally have the sort of bloody gladiatorial battle that every sport, you know, as a subtext, kind of has in it, but that it could be just as violent as you want it to be, and yet 100% safe, because the people driving the bodies on the field are not, in fact, supposed to be in danger at all. And, of course, as the book opens, it turns out that one of the players actually ends up dying, which should, be impossible, because they're merely driving an android body, not on the field themselves. And so the book unfolds following the investigation as to how this particular character died. And I agree that the sport itself is bloody, or is meant to feel bloody and violent and even a little bit ridiculous. But I also kind of believe that if that sort of thing could exist in the real world, we would definitely be doing it, and people would definitely be lining up to see it. Because people, you know, find violence, particularly violence in the context of sports, sort of exciting. You know, people get excited whenever there's a fight in a, you know, at a hockey game. With that old joke, I went to a fight and a hockey game broke out. So, you know, that's the, in athletics, there's always that sort of underpinning of the possibility of violence. And Hilketo, which comes from a Basque word meaning murder, merely just sort of follows that to its sort of natural conclusion.
And like a lot of popular sports, the NBA or the NFL or Major League Baseball, there's a lot of money involved. And one of the ways that they've monetized this sport is through selling data feeds to non-Haydens. This is big bucks.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Not just to non-Haydens, but to Haydens as well. But the point of it is everybody wants to have sort of the inside view to get as close to the sport as humanly possible. And in the future, I mean, aside from the fact that due to the nature of Haydens, because they have neural networks in their brains that are constantly checking, you know, their vitals to make sure everything's okay, but not only that, but because the android bodies are themselves uniquely designed to be able to have anybody look from that particular viewpoint, there is so much opportunity to get the audience, to get the spectators almost literally into the game. And I think that that's kind of an exciting idea as well. We're beginning to see more of that in sports anyway. If you look at a NASCAR race or any sort of race car event, they have the cams that are, you know, from the point of view of the drivers. I think we're going to see point of view from football player helmets, you know, in the reasonably near future, because all of that stuff is, again, really exciting, and it leads to viewer engagement. The things that I'm doing in the book with the sport Hilketo, again, are reasonable extrapolations of kind of where we are with life now. What I'm doing with the Hayden view, as you say, you know, the data about, you know, the heart rate and brain activity and the point of view of the players and stuff like that, is only two or three steps removed from what's going on in sports right now.
I agree. My guest is John Scalzi. His new novel is Head On, and you have an opportunity to meet him. He'll be at the Troy Miami Public Library in Troy tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. You can meet him and at the Troy Miami Public Library. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. It's the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis. John Scalzi returned to the program to talk about his new novel, Head On. I'd like to talk about my two favorite characters. The first one is Chris's partner, Agent Van. They have a really fine time together, and they play good cop, bad cop a lot, and Van is always the bad cop, and she is bad.
I don't know if I would say bad, but she certainly does not suffer fools. And of course, I put a lot of fools in her way because it's fun for the readers to get that. But I think it's important to have characters that have some bite to them, you know, and to have them be folks that, if you are in the same position as she is, dealing with people who you, because she's not stupid, she's very smart, and she knows when someone's trying to play her, right? She knows when people are lying to her, and she doesn't have time for that. And I think the way that she acts reflects that. And it also makes the sense, I also get the sense with her that she just wants to get to the point where they're going to get to anyway, right? She doesn't want to have to beat around the bush and spend hours and hours, you know, navigating through lies and dissembling and so on and so forth. It's just like, can we just get to the point here where we know where we're going to be because I'm busy and you're busy? And I think for everyone, that's a little bit of wish fulfillment, isn't it? To be the person who in your life just gets to say, I'm tired of, you know, the BS. Let's just get to it so we can all go and get a drink. Can we do that, please? So, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that people respond to her so well. And also, you know, with regard to being bad, I think part of it is also she gives herself permission to be strategically rude, which is the thing that I think all of us wish that we could do sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes you can't be the person who just, you know, cuts through the Gordian knot of BS. You have to put up with it, and it's super frustrating. So to have a character who's like, nope, not going to do that. You're going to do, you know, get right to it. I think so many people feels very satisfying because they wish they could do that themselves more often than they get to.
You always have comedic elements in your stories as well. And one of the funnier things, one of the funnier routines in this book to me was Chris's ability to destroy threeps.
Well, I think that that's, you know, it's part of the job, not in to destroy the threeps, but to recognize that as a FBI agent, sometimes you're going to be chasing bad guys and damage is going to happen to your vehicle, whether it is a car or whether it's a threep. But I also think that it's kind of fun to remind people that the threeps are not the character, because in the world, they're basically they're like cars. The cars that have two legs and two arms and a head and all that sort of stuff, and they're supposed to look like people. And when people who don't have Haydens, non-Haydens, or as we call them in the universe, Dodgers, when they interact with the threeps, of course, they're going to consider them being that person. And so we have to – I want the readers to remember that the person – is not the machine, and the machine is not the person. And one of the ways that I get to do that is to have the machines get banged up or to experience technical failure. There's one scene in the book where essentially Chris is running around desperately searching for to charge up because the threep Chris is in is down to like 13% power, right? And that's going to be a problem. It's sort of, and I think that also taps into people can understand that anxiety. Like I get full of anxiety anytime my phone drops under 25% power, right? Mm-hmm. Same sort of concept, but with a Android body.
Yeah, John, I'll note you were complaining about that on Twitter last week.
It's true. I was on a plane, and then we were on our way home, and my daughter used my – I always carry an external battery with me to charge up, and I let my daughter use the charge on the plane, and then her boyfriend, who was traveling with us, also charged his phone. So when they handed the battery back to me, I had no charge left in the external battery, and I was already down to like 25%, and we flew into Columbus rather than Dayton for whatever reason that we did that. And so all the ride home, I'm like, I'm down to 9%. Down to 7%, and it was really funny because on Twitter, which is where I was chronicling this, you know, people were like, "This is possibly the worst thing that's ever happened in the history of ever. How will you survive?" You know, they were combination. Everybody's been there, but at the same time, also mocking me.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun, and I got home at 2%. But again, this is kind of the extrapolation of things that people already understand now. You know, your battery on your phone getting down to 2% or 3% is something that when it happens to Chris, with Chris's body, people are going to be able to identify with it, even though it's talking about a technology that at the moment doesn't exist. Nevertheless, they've been there in their own life in a certain sort of way.
Mm-hmm. Another humorous aspect is the Hayden's personal space. I won't talk about that. We'll let readers discover that. Another very interesting aspect is the role of integrators. And I must congratulate you, John, for your prescience and timing. I'm sure you're delighted to have attorney-client privilege in the news right now.
Yes, I planned that.
Uh-huh.
All of this is going on exactly the way I wanted it to, which is, of course, not true at all. But it is funny. The previous book that I had come out last year was called The Collapsing Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the responses that I got to that particular title from people who hadn't read the book yet was, "That's a little on the nose, isn't it?" And I'm like, I thought of that title, you know, 4 years ago and only got around to writing it now. I can't take credit for prognostication. But it's certainly not a bad thing in terms of sales and interest when there is some even coincidental coordination between what's going on in your book and what's going on in the real world. And again, although this book takes place in the future, 20, 30 years in the future, it also takes place in Washington, D.C., and there are going to be some themes that I think people today are going to find familiar. One of the aspects I think that really does touch on people's concerns is the Haydens are concerned about their health, and they're concerned about how they're going to be able to pay for their health care, which is going to be significant given the nature of who they are and what's happened to them. And they had amounted to a government program that helped them with their care that was rescinded. And as this particular book goes along, we're beginning to see the results of what's going on with their lives as they cope with the new reality of having to personally compensate for what used to be taken care of or at least addressed by the government at large. And so that is something that I see people relating to at least a little bit. Again, you have to be careful because it's not a one-to-one issue. But again, the idea of taking things and issues that people are familiar with now and bringing them forward a little bit, that's certainly in play here.
My guest is John Scalzi. His new novel is Head On, and you can meet him tomorrow night. He'll be at the Troy, Miami Public Library. That's at 7 o'clock on April 30th in Troy, Ohio, in beautiful Miami County. And I see we're running out of time. John, at the beginning of the book, readers will discover that you had a hard time focusing on this book last year. You tried to explain that the deadline was pressing on you, and of course, for those of us who follow you, we know that you've got this multiple book contract. I'm sure you've got deadlines out there looming all the time. Why was it so tough for you to focus on this last year?
Well, in part because the way that I explain to people is it's sometimes hard to write what's going to be essentially a piece of escapist fiction when you feel like the world is on fire. Mm. And in the last year, particularly, the news that's coming out, you know, particularly out of Washington, but just everywhere, has been not only dramatic, but it's also been relentless. It's a recognition that no matter who you are, there's always going to be drama in the world. But right now, the world just seems to be a little bit more dramatic. Now, when I started off as a writer, I worked at a newspaper. I worked as a critic, and I also had a newspaper column where I talked about politics and I talked about current events, and I was, you know, paid to give my opinion. So in my DNA as a writer, the sensitivity and being attuned to current events is there, and it never went away. It's one of the reasons that I continued having to talk about politics and current events on my website, which is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. Mm-hmm. So it's very hard for me personally to filter any of that out because, again, it feels so dramatic. It has an impact on, you know, my day-to-day life and has an impact on the day-to-day life of my family, my friends, and my neighbors. And so whereas before, it would be easy for me to do 2,000 words at a time, you know, per day or something. The last year, I found it difficult to get, you know, 200 or 300 words. Hmm. Now, the good news is that sooner or later, you just have to put the, you know, nose to the grindstone and get it done. And one of the things that helped me is my editor finally came to me and said, we have to have this in by this particular date. And I was so relieved when he said that because it was like, fine, this is where I know everything has to end, get it done right there. So deadlines really actually can be your friend. But, you know, it continues to be an issue. I'm writing a book now, and I'll get some writing done, and I will check, you know, Twitter or check the news, and I'm like, and then I'm done for the day because off we go. So one of the things that I'm probably going to end up doing and probably will have my wife help enforce this is basically just pull the internet out of my house for about a month and basically do a detox. Mm. It'll drive me crazy, but I think it's going to be something that I need.
John says, give me a hard deadline. John, I mentioned earlier that I had two favorite characters in your book. One was Agent Van. Can you guess who the other one was?
Ooh, is it Donut?
You win, John. You win. Thank you, John. You know I'm a cat man, just like you.
It's been a really interesting. A lot of the early readers of the book were like, "I want to hear more about Donut the cat," mm-hmm. because Donut is a cat who plays a surprisingly large role in events in the book. But I have cats. Everybody loves cats, and to be able to put a cat in the book, I think does two things. One, it's just, you know, it's fun for me. But the other thing is it, again, brings up the point that even if people are in these android bodies, they are still people. And one thing that people love are their pets, whether it's a dog or a cat or whatever. And so to have Donut the cat not only be a good plot element, but to basically have everybody in the book say, I want to keep that cat. Can we keep the cat? Can we keep the cat? Mm-hmm. I think is just the way that most people would respond, because who doesn't love cats? I mean, aside from the people who are allergic to them.
Well, John, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.